Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Wednesday. Major story of the day, of course, is the Washington Post report that the Justice Department is investigating Trump's actions in the January 6th criminal probe. That during the grand jury investigation, they have been focusing on Donald Trump, what Donald Trump said, what he did, what was going on in these meetings. Now, this all sounds very, very promising. And then, of course, we also had Attorney General Merrick Garland sitting down with NBC's Lester Holt. And this is what the Attorney General had to say last night.
Look, we pursue justice without fear or favor. We intend to hold everyone, anyone who was criminally responsible for the events surrounding January 6th, for any attempt to interfere with the lawful transfer of power from one administration to another, accountable. That's what we do. We don't pay any attention to other issues with respect to that.
Okay, so good, but I'm sorry to be the guy raising the caveat. On yesterday's podcast, we talked with Andrew Weissman, a former Department of Justice prosecutor, who said, look, this is all good. There's more than enough evidence to charge Donald Trump criminally, but the clock is running. And there's going to be tremendous political pressure on them. If you haven't listened to the podcast from yesterday, you ought to listen to our conversation, because I asked Andrew Weissman, I said, so what if they don't go forward with the charges? What if they decide it's too heavy a lift and Trump is returned to the presidency? What would Trump 2.0 look like? And Andrew Weissman said, I don't think I have enough alcohol at home to even fathom that. But we're getting more and more glimpses again of what Trump's ideas are for Trump 2.0. Now, there's been a lot of attention to the fact that the former disgraced president returned to the scene of the crime, came back to D.C. to speak to a group of adoring fans. And, you know, because he didn't spend most of his time airing his grievances, some of the commentators in the punditocracy described Trump's remarks as a policy address. It was not a policy address because, folks, Donald Trump does not do policy. What he does, though, is play some of his greatest hits. And once again, he laid out kind of his American Carnage dystopian view. Let's play a couple of these clips, including his deep enthusiasm for killing drug dealers. I mean, this, again, keep in mind that this is the pro-life president who is very enthusiastic over the prospect of quickly executing drug dealers as they do. He doesn't name them by name, but as they do in places like China, the Philippines. This is what the president said about that.
And the penalties should be very, very severe. If you look at countries throughout the world, the ones that don't have a drug problem are those that institute a very quick trial death penalty sentence for drug dealers. It sounds horrible, doesn't it? But you know what? That's the ones that don't have any problem. It doesn't take 15 years in court. Mm. It goes quickly, and you execute a drug dealer and you'll save 500 lives because they kill on average 500 people.
Yeah, this is not something new from Donald Trump. By the way, I described him as the president. Obviously, he is the disgraced, defeated, twice impeached former president. This is not new for him. You know, he's repeatedly praised the policies of countries like the Philippines, where the former president, Duterte, is estimated to have murdered more than 6,000 drug dealers in 1 year. And Donald Trump looks at that and goes, cool, that'd be great. Trump went on to say that this was the American First Summit. He called for federal power to send the National Guard to restore order and to secure the peace without having to wait for the approval of some governor that thinks it's politically incorrect to call them in. The crowd loved that. This is the leader of the Party of States' Rights, basically saying, you know, I want to be able to send these troops into these cities without worrying about what the local governor has to say. He also got big applause when he mocked, pretended to be a transgender weightlifter after a bit about not wanting transgendered athletes in women's sports. And so, you know, there he is, with his little hands, you know, trying to show what it would be like to, you know, lift weights. Of course, Donald Trump, I don't think, has ever lifted anything heavier than money. And then, and this has gotten a lot of attention, his one big policy was to call for massive tent cities. This is hard to not sound like it's a parody, that he is, you know, besides the summary execution of drug dealers, he is proposing these massive internment camps for the homeless outside of cities. And clearly he wants to sound like he's given a great deal of thought to this policy to deal with the scourge of homelessness. Let's play that.
And then you look at the tents and the homeless and you say, what's happening to this great bastion? Perhaps some people will not like hearing this, but the only way you're going to remove the hundreds of thousands of people, and maybe throughout our nation, millions of people we're talking about, and help make our cities clean, safe, and beautiful again, is to open up large parcels of inexpensive land in the outer reaches of the cities, bring medical professionals, including doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, drug rehab specialists, build permanent bathrooms and other facilities, make them good, make them hard, but build them fast, and create thousands and thousands of high-quality tents, which can be done in one day. You have to move people out. Now, some people say, oh, that's so horrible. No, what's horrible is what's happening now. Because now they're in tents, but most of them aren't even tents that function.
So he didn't explain how he would get these people out, what the removal process would be, whether it would be voluntary, whether it would be involuntary. He also didn't explain how this would necessarily, quote unquote, solve the problem other than to round up millions of people and presumably with some sort of compulsion, forcibly have them sent to these camps, which would have permanent bathrooms, but obviously temporary tents. So I guess, you know, this is where it's like, what exactly is the policy here other than more Trumpy, you know, more sort of Trumpy, irritable gestures? And look, really, what says American greatness more than massive internment camps for homeless people, executions of drug dealers, border walls, federal troops in the cities, coups, and the mockery of sexual minorities. Am I right? And of course, the crowd was eating it up and is anxious to put Donald Trump back in the White House. Well, on the same theme, this is taking place, of course, in the midst of these January 6th hearings, which are not done yet. I thought it was interesting watching all the Republican politicians trooping to be the opening acts for Trump's appearance yesterday. You would never know from Kevin McCarthy's appearance or his comments that the nation is learning about what Donald Trump did and did not do surrounding the criminal conspiracy to overthrow the presidential election. But on today's show, we're going to look at the January 6th hearings, and we're going to look at it through the lens of the January 6th hearings as compelling reality TV shows, which again, looks at it through the lens that Donald Trump might look at those hearings. I'm really looking forward to talking with today's guest. James Poniewozik wrote one of the definitive books early on in the Trump administration, Audience of One, Donald Trump Television, and the Fracturing of America. James, welcome back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
James is the chief television critic for the New York Times. I remember you and I talked about your book at the time, which I thought was one of the most insightful takes about the media landscape and the way that Donald Trump is really a creature of it, and also I hate to say the word master practitioner, but you really can't understand Donald Trump without seeing him through the lens of a political culture that is shaped and often dominated by television.
Absolutely. I mean, he was, you know, he was a media celebrity before he was a politician. He was really a media celebrity before he was a businessman. And, you know, you don't get that big without being good at using the media in some way.
So, you know, last night I was on one of the cable shows and was asked about the whether or not there was a shift in the conservative media coverage of Donald Trump in the wake of the January 6th hearings. And of course, the Exhibit A and B, Wall Street Journal editorial ripping Donald Trump, the New York Post breaking bad on Donald Trump, other print publications on the right breaking bad on Donald Trump. And I guess my main caveat was, it's one thing for right-wing print publications to break bad on Donald Trump, but things are not really going to change until you see that trickle down into Fox News prime time and the other outlets that Donald Trump has weaponized so effectively over the years. Do you agree with that? I mean, how do you parse out what's going on right now? Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, Rupert Murdoch's New York Post breaking seriously bad against Donald Trump. But I'm not seeing that really in the world dominated by Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham. What do you think?
I'm pretty much with you on that. I mean, Fox News is still the front of the shop there. You know, it's going to get attention from political pundits and other journalists if the New York Post editorial page turns on Trump. But it's really going to make a difference if you start seeing that in Fox primetime. And, you know, I think that Fox, like any TV network, it's led by its viewership. It's led by its viewership as much as it leads its viewership. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there has just got to be this constant, as you saw when Fox changed toward Trump over the course of the 2016 primary, this kind of constant monitoring of the feedback loop to see kind of where the audience is on it now. You know, I think if you look at Fox and its position toward kind of Republican politics right now, maybe you could argue that they've gone in much more on Ron DeSantis mm-hmm. over the past year, you know, so maybe that is, you know, more of a bets hedging move, but it's going to be a much huger deal if somebody in Fox primetime, you know, casts a slightly negative light on Donald Trump, much less, you know, suggests that Joe Biden won the 2020 election than if the Wall Street Journal editorial board does.
This seems like a crucial point. The distinction you're making here is that outlets like Fox are really driven by their audience, that it's bottom up rather than having the content dictated from on high. There's a certain audience capture that takes place in the media. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's a feedback loop. You know, I think that, you know, Fox is not powerless in this. I mean, I think Rupert Murdoch's thing in journalism has long been, you know, kind of give the people what they want and the most red meat version of that. And that's been very successful with it. But that also comes, you know, with a certain risk that, you know, your audience kind of just evolves out of your control, you know, or that there is a danger in crossing them. So I certainly think that particularly once we saw again in the 2016 primary that there was only so much that, you know, quote unquote, elite conservative media opinion could do to move the conservative electorate. You know, I think there was a lesson learned that the tail was wagging the dog or the dog is driving the car, which crazy metaphor that I'm looking for. But you know, that basically, to some extent, the audience programs Fox.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about the piece that you wrote about the January 6th hearings. You wrote a column in the Times describing the hearings as water cooler TV. And I thought your analysis was really interesting because, you know, I mean, before they started, I think there was a lot of skepticism about whether these hearings would make any difference whatsoever. And, you know, as you point out, you know, investigating a threat to democracy was always going to be important, but it wasn't clear that it was going to be buzzworthy. But you wrote, this time it did manage to be buzzworthy. It became water cooler TV. So walk me through that. How did that happen? How did a congressional committee, I mean, look, these things are usually complete, you know, clown car clusterfucks of boredom. And yet they did manage to become a compelling television. So walk me through how those January 6th committees became what you called water cooler TV.
I mean, first of all, there was the decision up front that, yeah, this is a television event and we're going to make it as television. And a former president of ABC News with a lot of experience in producing nonfiction and documentary television was brought in to work on this and oversee it. And, you know, one of the first things that they decided is, yeah, we're gonna chuck the talk. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be, you know, 11 hours of going round robin around the committee and everybody takes 5 minutes to ask questions or grandstand. And, you know, you watch somebody lean into a microphone and drink water for 5 hours or whatever. You know, it's a medium. And, you know, again, like, this does not need to mean, you know, dumbing anything down or reducing your ambitions. But, you know, you're deciding that, you know, that you're realizing you're telling this story through a medium that tells its story largely through image. And so graphics are very important. Video clips are very important. You know, you need to kind of craft a narrative that people can follow and pick up and get through and know where they are and know where they're going. And so structure was also very important. You know, I found it very interesting that in a way, the committee had sort of some of the same challenges that somebody telling, you know, a serial story in scripted or streaming TV or whatever does, right? Don't get the audience lost. You know, if somebody has just dropped in or they haven't watched in a while, you got to give them a previously on and here's what's coming up. And they, you know, they were literally doing that sort of thing in the form of kind of recapping where we've been up to this point in some of the introductions and, you know, giving people guideposts going forward to, you know, where they were going to be going in the rest of the sessions.
I thought it was interesting the way you compared it to sort of the structure of TV miniseries, you know, how they will, you know, dive into the middle of things. They will create storylines. They will create characters. You have the surprise witnesses. It actually had that kind of rhythm. I mean, there were some missteps. There were some, I mean, it wasn't uniformly excellent. But, yeah. You know, as you point out, the odds were so strongly against this. I mean, maybe let's go back a little bit. You know, people are jaded. They're exhausted. There's all kinds of studies showing that people are bailing out of the media. I mean, ratings for television are down. I mean, obviously, you have MAGA World, which is hermetically sealed off from having to confront any of these things. And yet, you know, looking back on the, you know, 8 or 9 sessions, they succeeded in drawing an audience for public affairs television. They got other witnesses to come forward. You have some polls suggesting they might have moved a little bit of opinion on Trump, and it was watchable.
Yeah.
So in part, it was because they used the graphics, they used the clips, they used those 3D models of the executive dining room at the White House. I mean, was there any moment where you sat back and went, gosh, these guys really are getting how you construct a television narrative? Was there some moment?
Yeah.
I think it was when I started seeing the 3D models, I thought, okay, these guys, this is interesting. This is next level stuff.
That was certainly a thing for me, which they used early on. And with Cassidy Hutchinson, when she gave her testimony, you know, you're seeing, here's how far she is down the hall. It's like putting you in the room. You know, here's how far, you know, it's visually stating, here's how close this person is to power. And I almost felt like, bear with me here for this crazy analogy, but you watch Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So every episode of Game of Thrones opens with these credits where there's a map of Westeros and you come zooming in and there's a model of Winterfell and King's Landing. And it just, it looks really cool, but it performs a function. Game of Thrones is this complex, sprawling narrative, and it is helping situate you in space in this complex story. So you have a sense of, here's how far, you know, this thing that's going on with this character is from that one. You know, TV audiences often need that, and it was very interesting to see a congressional hearing use that. Another thing that jumped out at me just quickly was a couple, quote-unquote, episodes back when they were describing the, quote-unquote, unhinged meeting at the White House between Donald Trump and his, you know, bananas council trying to come up with ways to get the states to seize the machinery of the elections. And there was this 10-minute passage where they told the story almost entirely with video clips and just brief interjections from whichever representative was leading that part of the testimony. And it was like an oral history. And I really felt like I'm not watching a congressional panel. I'm watching like a really well-produced true crime documentary on Netflix. You know, this is how you tell that kind of story. And that was, you know, that was TV, and TV should be TV, or else it's not going to break through.
Well, and as you also point out, you know, casting is crucial to all of this. These witnesses weren't anti-Trumpers. They weren't never Trumpers. They were, I mean, some of them were, you know, sympathetic outsiders like the, you know, Capitol Police officers. But, you know, you had supporting characters. You know, you had Bill Barr, you know, calling Trump's conspiracy claims bullshit. You know, Richard Donahue, who's been, you know, was acting as deputy attorney general, was telling the story about telling Jeffrey Clark, how about you go back to your office? We'll call you when there's an oil spill. I mean, it was spicy, and there were interesting and compelling characters developed.
Yeah. And the spiciness is important. You know, that's, you know, obviously people care about ideas, but people respond to incident and a great story and a voice. And when you're giving people sort of, you know, these recurring characters like this, number one, again, it kind of, you know, places you within this network of alliances and characters who are working against or with each other. And also it just creates that investment that you get when you're watching a TV show where it's like, oh, it's that guy. That guy's hilarious. I remember this guy. Oh, this guy. That guy's nuts. You know, it's presenting people not just as like, you know, dry figures in a Wikipedia entry, but as living characters who are making decisions that feel real and live and impactful.
And every show has to have a compelling lead. And do you think it's Liz Cheney?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, within the ensemble, she is your sort of, you know, if you switch the analogy to being like a you know, procedural or investigative TV show, she's like your Mulder and your Scully, or, you know, your detective in an episode of Law and Order, you know, kind of leading you through the proceedings. But also with, you know, again, I was just impressed by the way she would drop these casual zingers that on the one hand were just, you know, sort of sick burns, like, you know, offhandedly, the president was taking advice from an apparently inebriated Rudy Giuliani, you know. Okay, like, now on one hand, that's just funny and, you know, good for you for taking your shot. But also, yeah, I don't know if this is conscious or subconscious, you know, that's something that's going to get repeated on social media. You know, that's something that's going to be, you know, a lead quote in the stories the next day. That's something that's going to generate attention and get people talking. And that focuses attention on the sort of serious meat of your argument. And, you know, there was sort of an element, I don't want to, you know, say Liz Cheney is quote unquote Trumpian. But, you know, one thing we learned from Donald Trump is that, you know, there is an element of showmanship to politics, and that in the modern media environment, drawing attention is a powerful thing.
Well, speaking of showmanship, I think one of the more extraordinary episodes was last Thursday night when they kind of just threw it in, the running Josh Hawley meme, which they dropped in and then took a break. It felt like, so social media could catch up so that somebody could put the Benny Hill theme underneath Josh Hawley. But I mean, that was also an example of, we're going to throw this out here. It may not be strictly relevant to what we are doing, but this is going to create, you know, this massive social media response. And I thought that was certainly an interesting decision on their part.
It really felt like, okay, here's 10 minutes, go to work on it, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
And the internet did. And there was just this sort of like, they didn't have to spotlight Josh Hawley, you know, running through the hallway. But once you thought of it, you know, how could you not do it? You know, and again, I think that's an example where, okay, number one, you know, it's just, you know, it is a devastating dunk on Josh Hawley. There is sort of a point to it where it's, you know, it's also saying, you know, he and people like him were playing footsie with this terrible force, and look what, you know, came of it. But also, you know, it's again sort of an element where you're giving the audience kind of the popcorn element that's going to provoke an emotional reaction or a laugh or whatever. And, you know, that in turn helps underline or spread your more serious argument that, you know, look, this vast network of people tried to throw out an American election.
So this was produced by James Goldston, former president of ABC News. And I thought it was interesting that you wrote that Goldston and the committee knew they had a thriller on their hands. I mean, you had conspiracy, backbiting, violence, even dark comedy, and they let it play like that on screen. And of course, the Josh Hawley being a pretty good example of that. So the hearings had that whole range of emotion, reading what you wrote. The hearings gave us both the tragedy of January 6th and the absurdity, the terror and the irony, the blood and the ketchup.
Yes.
I really thought that captured it. I mean, so you had this range. It wasn't all one note over and over again. I mean, I thought that was great. The blood and the ketchup, the terror and the irony. You had the absurdity, I mean, the outrage and the terror. And then you just had the pure insanity of it. So they had the kind of emotional narrative richness that you would expect from The Wire or Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
It was not usually a congressional hearing.
Right. Yeah. Because it was they in simple terms, they recognized that their job was storytelling. And storytelling is not just entirely about data. You know, you could imagine a version of this where somebody decided, oh, why bother spending time on the anecdote about Donald Trump throwing a plate against the wall? What does that really do, you know, about the larger charge? But, you know, number one, how can you not? And number two, you know, it's these sort of character, you know, emotional, just bananas, jaw-dropping moments. They are, in a kind of more indirect sense, creating this sense of an atmosphere of, you know, a situation that was kind of out of control. You know, and so I'd say, you know, the ketchup does matter. We need our ketchup.
And the fact that we know what the reference is to the ketchup running down the wall. So, and you know, again, as you wrote, this is summertime. People generally want to watch things like Stranger Things because they want to escape. But a lot of people still watch this. I mean, how do you describe the ratings? I mean, 17 million people, am I right about that? Watch that?
17 million for the second primetime one. I think it was a titch over 20 for the first one. Like, mm-hmm. It's not Super Bowl ratings.
Yeah.
These are big. It's huge for summer TV. It's, you know, bigger than I am pretty sure any scripted entertainment on TV now in an age of smaller ratings. I couldn't swear to this, but, you know, I think Yellowstone's the most popular scripted TV program now, and I don't think it draws 20 million overall for an episode. It's big.
Really?
Yeah, it's you know, it's a whole separate thing where, you know, in the history of TV, TV audiences individually are just smaller than they used to be. But, you know, this is bigger than This Is Us. It's mm-hmm. bigger than anything except like NFL football.
Well, let's put this in context. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, Fox News, but you know, on any, you know, given night, how many people are watching the Sean Hannity show?
I'm going to say Hannity, I couldn't, but Tucker, who I think is their top rated program now, three to four, something like that. And again, I'm not going to swear to that figure, but it's in that neighborhood.
In that range.
And that's the biggest thing on cable news.
Yeah. Right. So the biggest thing on cable news is 3 or 4 million. This was pulling 20 million, 17 million. I think that puts it in context. So you close your review of the January 6th hearings, alluding to the famous, you know, Army McCarthy hearings. And you closed with this line: the committee took its shot, told its story, and trusted we still had decency at long last. Of course, a reference to the, you know, the famous quote, you know, at long last, have you no decency, sir? And that's the most memorable line of congressional hearings. This feels like it's more of sort of accumulation of facts, of lines, of imagery. You know, there's no one line that's going to be like the Army McCarthy hearing that's going to be devastating, but there is that accumulation that seems to be taking some toll.
Yes, it's more the collection of this scene and this water cooler moment and that water cooler moment. And, you know, look, I think the easy thing to say is, oh, a hearing these days is not going to, you know, change politics night and day. And, you know, obviously that's true. You know, America is a different place than it was in the 1950s. The media environment is different. There isn't the same sort of social consensus or, you know, agreement on a shared set of facts. But, you know, within that, there are still people that are willing to listen to things. There are still ways of getting people's attention in ways that matter. And just like a, you know, TV network or producer that's trying to create a risky, ambitious show, with something like this, it's easy to talk yourself out of it and say, you know, this stuff never, quote unquote, moves the needle anymore. At some point, you've got to decide, listen, if I think this is important, I got to trust that there's an audience out there that's going to listen to it and care about it. And we tell them what the stakes are, and they're going to decide, you know, the stakes, the idea of America still having free democratic elections, that's something I'm going to care about enough to listen, you know.
Okay.
And that was really their first step, that they trusted the audience.
So let's talk about how Donald Trump is seeing this. My sense is that even though there might be some people on the right who are trying to sneer and say this doesn't matter, that Donald Trump, who has lived his entire life, you know, on television and watching television, that, well, tell me how he thinks about this, because I think he kind of gets the fact that this is a problem for him.
Trump knows television instinctively. You know, just one thing he has a gift at is knowing when something's breaking through and knowing the thing that's going to like grab people's attention. And you saw him responding in real time, for instance, to Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. You know, whatever anybody else was going to say, he knew like this is something that's going to cut through. This is a figure that, you know, people are going to pay attention to and believe. And I got to step in. And you know, throughout Donald Trump's presidency, he closely monitored the big TV events of his, you know, he watched, you know, Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings and, you know, was sort of taking notes on like how well he thought he was, you know, defending himself and so forth. So I think, you know, Trump has no illusion, you know, that these hearings are, you know, not making a difference. I think, you know, he has seen them as a threat and as something that's gotten attention, and it may have, you know, I think there's even been, you know, reporting on this, you know, it influenced his toying with the idea of, you know, declaring for president at a certain time, or at least talking about declaring for president as a way of getting attention back. So, you know, I think he certainly sees that there is a threat and a battle for attention here.
He seemed to be triggered the most by Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. And I have to think, I try to think of this through the lens of how he's looking at this. And he has that obsession with people who look like they're from central casting. And I just had the sense that he's looking at her and her testimony, which was so compelling and so effective. And in many ways, this was a worst case scenario for him. I mean, that had to bother him a lot more than, say, Judge Michael Luttig.
You just think of, you know, movies and TV shows that you've watched in the past and try to, like, look at this in the context of that. You know, young person who was working with a lot of more powerful older people and was kind of the fly on the wall and is taking a big risk as a young woman coming in and testifying. That is, and, you know, just inherently, just in terms of Hollywood storytelling, you know, a figure that people are going to feel sympathy for. And, you know, Donald Trump was on a reality show for 14 seasons. You know, he knows about casting. He knows about, you know, the idea that people see like a certain figure on TV and they take in a, you know, just a few data points about them and they create a reaction. So, yes, I think, you know, when he sees on her, he sees like this is a kind of person who could be very damaging to me.
OK, so let's have a slight digression here because you also wrote a piece celebrating the 20th anniversary of what I think is the greatest television series ever. The Wire.
The Wire, yes.
You know, and I have to say that The Wire spoiled me in a long-lasting way because it is so outstanding. And as you point out, it's been two decades, but its reputation's only grown bigger. I mean, it's one of those, your point, it's one of those series like the original Star Trek that I think that people are going to have a hard time realizing. I actually was a little bit surprised to be reminded that originally it struggled with low ratings during its entire run. But
yeah.
You asked the question, has anyone made another Wire since? I mean, really, I mean, what made that so distinctive? And put it in some context about how extraordinary that series was.
For starters, yes, you're right. It never had good ratings, and its reputation has grown since it aired. But you know, part of the thing was that it was doing something that was, you know, difficult at the time, and it's been difficult to do since, which is to, you know, create a cop show that wasn't just about, you know, neatly solving, you know, a case of the week, but is, you know, more in the matter of like a Balzac novel or something, trying to create this giant canvas of a society and a city and just show every part of what makes things run and to tell a story that has like a lot of fascinating characters, but isn't really about, you know, superheroic characters who have the power to change their destiny. A lot of what The Wire was about was, you know, systems are really powerful and it can be really hard to beat them. And it's tough to kind of make that kind of systemic storytelling into entertaining storytelling. You know, and the Wire pulled that off really well. Honestly, the handful of shows that I can think that have tried to do similar things since then have often been by, you know, people who were involved with The Wire, you know, David Simon's subsequent shows, you know, Treme, The Deuce. You know, it's just, it's still 20 years later. You know, if you made that 20 years later, that would still be a risky TV show to make.
Well, I remember watching it and thinking, I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea. And also the complexity of it. I think that was also the fact that, as you described it, as realistic and meticulously messy. And also, there were no simple answers there. I mean, you weren't convinced that they made much of a difference, you know, if the cases got solved at all. But you said it was not like cable dramas like The Sopranos that were built around charismatic antiheroes. So how do you compare and contrast The Wire with The Sopranos, which, by the way, I have not yet seen. So,
oh, well, so
I'm saving
it
for my old age. No, I know. I have it. I'm saving it for, but how is it different?
You know, a show like The Sopranos is sort of in the model of, you know, it's focused on a compelling central character, Tony Soprano, who is in many way, you know, the master of his destiny. You know, he makes decisions and they affect the larger story. People, you know, support him or they fight against him, but they're reacting to him. It's sort of, you know, to like put it in social science terms, it's like the great man theory of history. The idea that, like, you know, there's just this one person can have grand effects on his world. And yeah, the Wire was, you know, it was an entertaining story of people doing things, you know, cops performing these painstaking investigations and the wars within drug gangs and political maneuverings at City Hall. There was a lot of exciting action going on, but it was really a story about futility, ultimately. You know, a lot of it was, you know, the first season is kind of about, we put in, you know, all these hours in this intense investigation to take down a drug kingpin, and here we go, and we did it, and the drugs are still getting sold. And, you know, it was just like you were just, you know, sweeping back a wave, you know, on the beach with a broom. And that's just a big difference.
Yeah. Well, as you point out, it's not really a cop show. I mean, yeah. It opened the door that other cop shows didn't enter. I mean, labor, education, media criticism, and each one of the episodes was, remember when the one scene with the new mayor is, you know, sitting around there talking about fixing the schools, and I think it lasts about 30 seconds. Somebody says, no, we can't do anything about it. I mean, we don't want to go into those depths. And that's it. There's just, that's it. They just decide they're not going to do anything about the schools. Or when Omar is killed and they're sitting around the newsroom and the news story comes up and what I think it gets cut, right? It's like one paragraph and he doesn't even make the newspaper. I actually thought that was one of the most realistic portrayals of a newsroom that I have ever seen.
Yeah, I agree. And kind of makes the point that, you know, this, you know, vast story that you have been just deeply invested in for five seasons is just a ripple in the larger world. That was really kind of understatedly devastating.
James Poniewozik, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I appreciate it. The book is Audience of One, Trump Television and the Fracturing of America, which has aged very well. I think it has stood up to the test of the last few years very, very well. And of course, you can read James's work in the New York Times. Your piece on the January 6th hearings is water cooler TV, I think, is a must read. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Charlie. I had a lot of fun.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio production by Jonathan Siri. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, and we'll be back tomorrow to do this all over again.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
At Audi Columbus, luxury meets convenience. Family-owned since 1897, we've built our reputation on trust, transparency, and innovation. Browse our selection online and complete your purchase from home. Then, simply stop by to pick up your keys.
Drive home the new 2025 Audi A3 for $419 for 36 months with $3,685 down.
The next generation shops online. Experience the future with us at AudiColumbus.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 6/30/25.